Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, hopefully you listeners out there have hung in with us. We've had a snafu here at the station. Freedom 970, we had a little mix-up here on the engineering. So hopefully we've got it worked out now. And we do have in studio with me Carl Jepson with the Warren Island Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Carl. And, you know, I'm going to get right to it. We got Harry Dent holding on the line. And, Harry, are you there?
Yes.
Great. Well, listen, I do want to say Harry Dent is a author, economist, and senior editor of the free newsletter Economy and Markets Daily. We have a link on our website. You can also go to harrydent.com, sign up for that free newsletter. And I got to tell you, I send a lot of my clients who do their own investing, you know, a little higher risk and stuff. Harry has a wealth of stuff on there and information and different programs that people can sign up for that are outstanding, some of the best in the industry. And so I really recommend you, if you're a self-investor, you cannot ignore Harry Dent's website. You just can't do it. Harry, we're really glad to have you on the air. Sorry for the mix-up today. Had a little engineering problem. But there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in the economy. And I have to ask you, because my phone rang off the hook this week, about the new bank, the new Asian bank.
I actually did not hear about that this week. I was in Puerto Rico. We're trying to finish a house down there on an island, so I was kind of a little out of the loop, but not surprising.
Well, the one real question is they're talking about that, you know, Europe, Italy, all these countries are joining this Asian bank set up by China and are leaving the World Bank, and basically what they're going to do is they're not going to make the dollar the main dollar. And so, you know, and one of the things a lot of guys have called me about is the gold bugs, because supposedly China has got all this gold, and they're going to make basically the gold standard of the dollar.
This, Chuck, this is not going to happen. I'm just telling you, we told people for years, my partner Rodney Johnson and I, nobody can afford to become the reserve currency. Nobody can afford to back up their currency with gold. China can't afford to sell our treasury bonds. They hold too many of them. If they were to become, if the euro or the Chinese or any other major country or bloc were to become the reserve currency, their currencies would appreciate and their exports would collapse. China exports 35 to 50% of its GDP. The U.S. only exports 10 to 13%. Germany exports 50%. Most European countries, 30 to 50%. They can't afford. All this stuff is just gold bugs talking to themselves and wanting to go back to a gold standard when there's only enough gold in the entire world to fill one Olympic swimming pool. Gold cannot back global currency today. It could back in the 1800s. It could back at the time of Rome. We're never, ever, ever, mark my words on this, going back to a global gold standard. A few countries may do it. China is not going to dump U.S. Treasury bonds, and China is not going to back their currency with gold. I'll make that prediction very confident.
Okay. Well, the key thing I'm looking at here is, and the concern I have is the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Japan, Italy have all signed on with this Asian bank. And that...
Yep, that's fine. Everybody's covering. I mean, there's a certain amount of trade being done outside of U.S. dollars, but I'm just telling anybody who wants to hear it clearly, soundly, the dollar is not going to lose its reserve currency status. At some point, we may have a basket of currencies, but even that would take years to work out.
Well, and I know, yeah, this has been all over the all over the news and stuff about the de-dollarization accelerates as more Washington's allies defect to China-led bank. And that,
yeah, well, you know, people should listen to us because we've been the only person in the entire world in the last few years saying the dollar's going up, not down. Every Goldberg says the dollar is going to zero, gold's going to $5,000, and they have been 100% absolutely dead wrong. So if you want to listen to the Goldbugs, be my guest.
They don't understand deflation. Yep.
They don't understand, number one, we've put out numbers of articles in our newsletter showing there's more dollar-denominated debt in the world, 40, 50% more than euros, 3-4 times as much as Japanese yen, way more than Chinese yuan, and when you have a global deflation and debt gets restructured and financial assets fall in value like they did in the 1930s, there's going to be more dollars destroyed than any other currency, and the less of a currency you have globally, the more it's worth. That's what gold bugs don't get. We are going to have a crisis, but it's going to make the dollar down the road more valuable, not less. Who's going to say, oh, we got to run from the horrible U.S. reserve currency when it's going up and all other currencies are going down? And that has been the trend for years. Dollar up, everything else down.
Well, I totally agree with you, Harry. Yeah, absolutely. And we've been saying that, and that's why I wanted you to talk about it, because I've had a lot of people ask about this on the currency, and I've been telling them for years, when things get bad, we're still going to be the survivor. We're still going to be the place people are going to send their money.
We're the best house in a bad neighborhood. It doesn't mean we're a good house. It doesn't mean the Fed hasn't done crazy stuff. Printing money, something for nothing economy, never, ever, ever works out well in history. So this is not going to work out. The Fed's just creating a bigger bubble. They're not creating inflation, because you can't create much inflation in a deflationary environment where there's peak debt and everybody's borrowed more than they can, and all companies are doing is borrowing money for free and buying back their own stock. I mean, that's how they're growing their earnings the most. So it's an artificial economy. The danger for what the Fed's doing is that this money goes into the financial markets because it has nowhere else to go. It's not being lent. It's not expanding capacity and expanding the economy like past recoveries. It just goes into financial speculation. We've got a bigger bubble in stocks than we had in 2007, very close to what we had in the biggest bubble of all modern history, 94 to 2000, the tech bubble. And this bubble's going to burst, and when it does, it's going to destroy tens of trillions of dollars of consumer wealth, and even more of that in financial assets. So it's just, this is going to fail. What most people are doing, Chuck, the big problem I see out there, I debate the gold bugs all the time. We agree 100% on how far out we are on debt, how printing money can't work, something for nothing. But then they go to ideology and say, well, the dollar's going to collapse and there's going to be hyperinflation and gold's going to go to 5,000. They're not looking at the facts. We look at the facts. What actually happens when a bubble bursts, when a debt bubble bursts? You can't go back to the 1970s. You got to go all the way back to the 1930s or to the 1990s in Japan to see what happens when a financial and a debt-driven bubble actually bursts. You get deflation, not inflation. And if you get deflation, gold's going to go down and the dollar's going to go up, the opposite of what gold bugs say, even though, again, when I give a presentation with these gold bugs, I have to take out half my slides. They've got the same slides on how high debt has grown, how out of balance everything is. But they don't understand because they're going on ideology. Hey, the last time we had a global crisis, gold was the savior. Well, it was, because that was an inflationary crisis. This is a deflationary crisis, and this should be obvious by now because we printed $11 trillion globally, and we've got lower inflation than we had at the top of the last bubble and boom. Lower inflation. So all this inflation has just barely kept us from falling into deflation. We're fighting, the central banks are fighting deflation. If that's the ultimate trend, when that does become reality, which it will, because you can't keep a bubble going forever. I don't care how much money you print. Then when we get deflation, the dollar's going to rise. Gold, commodities, stocks, real estate, everything else is going to fall, and most currency is going to fall. So where are you going to go? you know, safe U.S. dollar investments, not euro, not yuan, not yen. U.S.
Well, yeah, it's a fact. When things hit the fan, they're going to come to the U.S., no question about it. And, one of the things I noticed going on in the interest rate cycle, that 10-year treasury just keeps going down. I mean, it comes back to 2, and then it goes right back down. Like, it closed yesterday at 1.93. That is unbelievable, a low rate for a 10-year treasury.
Well, but it's 0.2 in Germany. It's 0.3 in Japan.
I know. Well, Germany went negative
last. We're the best house in a bad neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, Germany, in January, I think it was, Germany went negative on their dollar.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were negative.
Well, and most of these rates, when you adjust for inflation, see, short-term rates, the Fed can and central banks can just set at zero, and that's what most of them have done. The way they impact long-term rates is through quantitative easing, by buying their own sovereign bonds and mortgage bonds and things like that, and government-sponsored bonds and guaranteed bonds, they drive interest rates down to zero adjusted for inflation. So if you take the 2% treasury and adjust for an average 2% inflation rate in the last 3 or 4 years, you're basically getting money for free. Now, I can tell you in history, and this is the worst time in history, when governments make money free or near free, it gets abused. It gets misinvested. It goes into speculation. Hedge funds are trading on 30 to 50 times leverage because they can borrow money at nothing and just leverage up into a 2% treasury bond and end up making a very safe, high-yield investment free because of the Fed. But this is just causing speculation. And the more these yields go down, the more investors have to say, well, gosh, the only place I can get a yield is to buy a Fortune 500 company with 3% dividend. So they're all piling into there, and then they're piling into junk bonds, which normally would trade at 8 to 10% in normal times. They're trading at 5. 5% for a risky bond, 5.5% for the riskiest, these stupid frackers who are going to blow up all over the place. 5.5% you can borrow money for risky oil drilling. That's misinvestment. The whole fracking bubble was a misinvestment. It ain't going to happen. It's over. They're dead. Fracking will never exist again to any substantial degree. Once these wells run out, which they will over the next 6 to 12 months on average, they're not going to be able to pay off their debt, and they're not going to be able to raise new money and drill.
You're going to make a lot of people disappointed that are getting those royalty checks from all the drilling over there.
Yeah. But this is just reality. Fracking was a bubble. Without Fed stimulus, without pushing junk bonds from 8 to 10% down to 5 to 5.5%, without the artificial recovery that took oil from $32 back to $115, without those two factors, which were a direct result of quantitative easing and nothing else, fracking would have never even gotten off the ground. Frackers need $55 to $80 just to break even. We will never see $80 oil in the next decade or two, is my forecast. The Prince Talawat, or whatever, the great prince over in Saudi Arabia, who's the best investor in the Middle East, said, we will never see $100 oil again. I say we won't even see $80 in the next few decades.
Wow.
So these guys are dead.
Yeah, they're toast.
Trillions of dollars got invested. A million plus jobs got created. $6-7 trillion worth of debt got created over this thing, and it was misinvested. It's going to end up being worthless. So we just blew a bunch of money. Well, think of all the investments that have been made. Think of companies buying back their stock at higher and higher prices, and when those stocks collapse, how stupid they're going to look. Buying back their own stocks and bidding it up, and then it collapses 50, 60, 70, 80%. It looks great now that everything keeps going up and the Fed keeps things going. As soon as something goes wrong, these guys look like idiots. Everybody's an idiot. Anybody buying anything but a 10-year or 5-year or 1-year treasury bond or T-bill is going to look like an idiot.
Yeah,
that's what happens when bubbles burst.
Yeah, well, and a good example was in 2000 when the tech bubble popped. There were companies that were such high earnings per dollar ratio was just out of sight. There was no
AOL was actually, Chuck, if you remember, AOL was 400 times earnings, and it was the one thing. If it was a tiny startup, It was a large company by then. No
yep.
company on earth can grow fast enough, long enough to fulfill a PE like that. People were just buying, like you said, because it was going up. They thought you couldn't lose. We're in a new era of prosperity. The same thing investors were saying in 1929 before that great bubble burst. And that's what happens. Bubbles suck everybody in because people get easy money, something for nothing. They love it. It's a high. It's like a drug, and they want more and more and more of it. And then when it bursts, they feel like total idiots, and they lose everything. This is what's getting ready to happen. History repeats itself. History's crystal clear on this. Every major bubble of this size or greater in history has always burst. And when these bubbles burst, you get deflation, and you get debt restructuring, and financial assets fall across the board, everything, real estate, commodities, stocks, international, high-yield bonds, everything but the safest bonds and the strongest currencies fall.
We know, Harry, and
that's the story. Anybody looks at history shouldn't even debate this. It is so crystal clear. But everybody's in the bubble. Everybody's listening to CNBC, and all these idiots get up there and say, oh, it's not a bubble because of do-do-do-do-do, not a bubble because of d-d-d-d-d. I'm like, if it looks like a bubble, quacks like a bubble, it's a bubble, damn it. And this is a bubble. That is my statement to anybody, and nobody wants to hear it. But I'm telling you, it's a bubble, and if you don't get out of the way, you're going to lose your entire retirement account.
Yeah, you know, we've been saying this for some time, and I got to tell you, I had to really laugh the other day because Japan finally had a decent day in the market, and you would have thought it was New Year's Eve or something. All the money stations were all boohooing Japan, like maybe you ought to start dumping your money in Japan. And they've been in a 20-year recession.
Yeah, it's actually now going on 25 years. Their market peaked at the very end of 1989, the stocks, and they went down 82% at the low in early 2009. Real estate peaked 2 years later in 1991, went down 60%, way more than ours has, and has never bounced 23 years later. People got to get real. Bubbles burst, and when they finally burst and governments can't keep the bubble going, which they're doing now, everything goes down, and it doesn't go running back to new highs. We will never, ever, ever, ever see real estate or stocks in Japan anywhere near their highs. Never in over the rest of the century, on your lifetime, your kid's lifetime, and your grandkid's lifetime. U.S. stocks may get back in decades to, you know, 18,000 or wherever they peak here near term. But that's about as good as they'll do. We don't have the demographics we had in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, not for decades. We have fewer millennials to do everything from enter the workforce to buy houses to buy cars. There's fewer of these. There's more baby boomers at peak. So we will never see a boom like 83 to 2007 again. We will see a recovery once this washes out and once the next generation comes along. But that's early in the next decade. Between now and then, stocks have an 80% downside, is my projection, give or take. Every major bubble burst in history has seen stocks go down 80% or more. That includes Japan in the last 20-some years, just as you said, and includes the U.S. stock market in the 1930s. Actually, it was down 89% at worst. That is what you expect when a bubble bursts. Not 20% correction, not 50, not 60, 80%. Is the golden rule if you go back in history and say, what happens when a major debt and financial asset bubble bursts? So anybody sitting in stocks collecting 2 to 3% dividends, that's my warning.
Yeah, and I agree 100%. You know, that's one of the things that people don't realize. When we had that bubble pop in 2008, the markets actually went down almost 50% at one point in time. So
yep.
it was a deep
dish. And that's when the Fed came in and totally turned it around, printing trillions of dollars in everybody around the world. I mean, imagine if central banks had not come to the rescue and flooded globally the markets with money, that we would have already seen, I think, 80% down by now. So we've got to see that down the road. All they've done is push this thing down the road. And, of course, if you're going to push something down the road and create more leverage, more speculation, more debt, and we have more debt than we had in 2008 at the peak, $57 trillion more around the world, so we haven't deleveraged at all. We have more debt. When the bubble finally blows, it's just going to be worse. So, I mean, 80% is probably on the optimistic side.
Harry, is there any one Harry, is there any one institution? I mean, like Congress or the Fed or the the federal government that could somehow hold this, not necessarily hold it off, but minimize the effects of the bubble burst?
Well, that's what they've done in Japan for 20-some years. What they have is what I call in Chapter 2 of my book, the coma economy. They've been printing money way longer than we have now for almost 20 years, and they've printed over 50% of their GDP. We've printed 25%. So they've printed twice as much relatively, and they're printing at three times the rate we were doing QE3 currently. So they're printing money like crazy, been doing for 20 years, and guess what? Their GDP has averaged zero over the last two decades. Their productivity has averaged zero. Their inflation is zero. They're in a coma. They're like on life support, barely alive, kept alive only by quantitative easing and life support. And Japan's government debt now is 260% of GDP. It started at 60%, at the top of the bubble. So they've added massive amounts of debt. And when interest rates normalize at some point in the future, even if it's 10 years from now, in Japan, they're going to be dead. If interest rates, if they just had to pay 2-3%, which way lower than long-term average on their government bonds, their entire revenue would go to paying the interest on those bonds. Japan is dead. They're like the frackers. They're dead. Nobody's announced the funeral yet. They're staying alive, barely on life support, and we're doing a little better than that. That's because our demographics are better, but our demographics get worse steadily again. Started in 2008, but it gets worse steadily from 2015 into 2020 to 2023. So it's not going to take much for this thing to blow. I think the frackers are the first thing. I think of oil. We've been saying for years, as you know, Chuck, that oil was going to go to $10 to $20 a barrel.
Yep.
Commodity prices have peaked long term. Gold's going to go to $250 to $400 or at least $700. All of this stuff's happening. But these frackers are the first to go. When oil doesn't bounce back to $80 to $100 like Boone Pickens and everybody is hoping, and the industry is hoping, then these frackers are dead. They're going to default on their debt. Well, when they start defaulting, then junk bond owners are going to say, oh my gosh, who's next? And junk bond yields are going to go up like they did in 2008. They're going to spike. And then more and more people are going to default. And there's $7 trillion, actually nine by the last count I got recently, $9 trillion of U.S. denominated debt outside of the U.S. in addition to the $60 trillion inside domestically. That's going to default because as the dollar keeps going up, these people have to pay higher interest and principal because it's priced in dollars. All of these countries are paying more, so they're going to default. So you just get one default after the next. The next thing you know, you got a global financial crisis because all it took, and I have to remind people this every time, all it took was four states in the U.S. in 2008 moving into a subprime crisis for the entire world to go down. Every stock market down 50, 60, 70%. Debt defaults around the world. A lot of real estate markets cracking. Commodities collapsed. Oil went from $147 to $32 in 4.5 months. This is what happens when bubbles burst. And people are sitting there saying, well, but the Dow's still going up. I'm like, okay, you want that extra 1, 2, 3, 4% that you might get if you're really lucky? And do you know that the first crash in the Dow in 1929 over a matter of months was 40%? The first crash in the NASDAQ back in early 2000 in a month and a half was 41%. So if you even waited for the first drop and got out, you were already down 41%. So you want that extra 1, 2%? You want that 2% P&G dividend? Boy, people have no idea what may be about to hit them.
Well,
with the herd, and they're listening to all these analysts, and the central bankers say it's okay and it's not a bubble, and the analysts say that, and economists say, oh, the Fed's doing the right thing. They are not doing the right thing. They are taking away honest savings rates where you should be getting 2-4% on a good government bond, and they're forcing people into stocks because there's nowhere else to go. So everybody who's following this is going to go off the cliff with the Fed.
Well, yeah, Japan's on QE8. We entered at QE3, but we're probably going to have QE4.
And then look where they are. They're still dead.
Yeah.
They are a retirement community in hock. That's what Japan is. In 20, 30 years, there aren't going to be any Japanese. And all the old people are going to die, and there's going to be young people with no jobs and no retirement plans.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, you gave one of the best examples at one of your talks one time I was at, where you talked about the economy like a big balloon, and you can only put so much air in that balloon, and
right.
Eventually...
At some point, it will burst. Exactly.
It will burst. It's going to blow up, and when it blows up, it's going to take a long time to put it back together.
Yes, that's right. And the more it's blown up, and the more debt you create, and the more financial asset bubbles. I'll tell you another good example that I use is if you simply, and anybody can do this, you just take pebbles of sand and drop them on the floor, you will build a mound. It will get steeper and steeper and steeper and steeper, and then one pebble will cause an avalanche. You don't know which pebble. You know when it's getting close. You know when it's getting steep, but all it takes is one pebble to cause that whole mound to collapse and have an avalanche. That's what bubbles are like. All it takes is a trigger, like these frackers could be enough. If oil just goes down to 20 to 30 bucks in the next year and doesn't bounce back above 30 or 40, these frackers are going to default. End of story. They're going to be dead. And when people realize they're dead, as I said earlier, junk bond yields are going to start spiking up. People start worrying about debt. You know, nobody's worried about debt. Oh, it's okay. You know, well, the Fed won't let the economy fall. Well, what is the Fed? The Fed created the fracking bubble, and it's going to burst. So they created the trigger that's going to shoot them in the ass. That's what they've done, and they deserve it.
Well, I got to do a little shameless selling here, Harry. I'm going to talk to you about your Irrational Economic Summit coming up September 10th to 12th in Vancouver at the Fairmont there, and I'm all signed up. I am anxious, ready to go. And my question to you is going to be maybe not a fair question for a short term, but is this bubble going to keep going until we have our meeting, or do you think it might pop before?
My best prediction is that we're peaking right about now. I've been waiting for the NASDAQ it's the only major indices that has not made a new high. It hit 5,042 on Friday. At 5,048, it would retest its closing all-time high in March of 2000, and at 5,132, its intraday high. I'm seeing that as a very likely peak. We could have peaked on Friday. We got close enough, but I just said in my latest high-end newsletter, it's called Leading Edge, I said my prediction is that we have a 90% chance of a 20% correction this year and a 70% chance that we're going to peak in the near term, long term, and never see these levels for decades. That's my two predictions, 70% that we're actually peaking near term. At worst, we're going to get a 20% correction like we got in 2011, and then we might go up and make some slight new high later this year or something. But this is very bubbly, and it's looking, to me, if I had to guess, I'd say the market's peaking right in this time frame.
Yeah, I've kind of had that feeling, too. And I think even now, there's more and more people finally starting to talk about two things that you've been talking about for years is the bubble, and they're also talking about deflation. And that used to be a taboo. I can remember when you were on several news talk shows and you would bring up deflation and those guys would just go ballistic on you saying,
yeah.
Oh, we can't have deflation. We're going to have hyperinflation. And you said, no way are we having hyperinflation.
And no way is the dollar going down. Now, I even said last week, hey, the dollar's due for a correction. I mean, it just zoomed up. I mean, I was in Italy several years ago at the peak of the euro at 160, and then it's fallen to 105 recently. We've been saying for years the dollar's going to go to parity and likely lower versus the euro. I think it's going to be 85 cents in the next few years, but you know, we're already almost hit parity. I mean, people have been calling me crazy, and I just yell back at them. I'm the only sane person looking at the actual facts, looking at actual history, and not preaching ideology. Everybody's on ideology that the Fed's, you know, omnipotent, or the gold bugs that, you know, the dollar's got to go to zero and gold's got to go through the roof. That's ideology. History does not support that. Gold will go through the roof, as it did in the 70s, in an inflationary crisis, which you only get once in a lifetime. Like, you know, 1920 and 1980, peak inflation. You see that once in a lifetime. The economy throughout history goes from a spring boom with low inflation rising to an inflationary recession, stagflation, like we saw in the 70s, to a disinflationary bubble boom like we saw in the Roaring Twenties and we saw in a recent decade, and then to deflation. That's the only pattern the economy has ever had. And to think we're going to go from disinflation over all these decades back to inflation is lunacy. It doesn't not happen in history, period. No bubble in history of this magnitude has ever gone on forever without crashing and causing havoc. This is history. It's 100% crystal clear, and people are calling me crazy. They're crazy. They're in bubble land.
Yep, I agree 100%. Hey, I do want to get
bubble logic.
I do want to get back and push your irrational. Is it sold out yet?
No, I think we still have seats. I mean, it's not only. I mean, we had a great conference in Miami last year with David Stockman, and he's coming back in Skype this time. We're going to have Lacey Hunt, who is my favorite real economist. And it's in my favorite city in all of North America, Vancouver, and the best time of year, early September. I mean, August, early September in Vancouver is just heaven. So I couldn't be happier with the slate of speakers and where we're having it. So, well, yeah, I would sign up.
Yeah, I've been encouraging people and clients that I have, and we've been talking about it on our show every week, about that people can sign up, and they can go on my website or they can go to hsdent.com and sign up for it as well. And they really ought to. If you're a self-investor or you're somebody who just wants to learn about the economy, I got to tell you, Lacey Hunt, I signed up for his stuff too.
Yeah.
That guy is great. He really is.
He is great. We had him speak in La Jolla, San Diego, a couple of years ago, and obviously people love him. I mean, the quote was, "He sounds like he has the voice of God."
he does. He. I think if they were looking for somebody to take Charlton Heston's place, it'd be Lacey Hunt. Yeah, he's great.
And again, you know, he is a real classical economist. I'm not a classical economist. I came out of business consulting and marketing and business strategy and finance and accounting, everything about business. That's how I was able to see things differently. But he is a classical economist who understands history and understands how debt bubbles build and how they always end in deflation. He's one of the few people I can get up and talk with and have a Q&A session afterwards, and he's somebody that actually understands history and how this happened, and he's not operating on ideology like the gold bugs. So, yeah, he is. We couldn't get him last year, but we got him this year again. So,
well, you know, Harry, one of the things I've told a lot of my clients, and people have asked me about going to an irrational economic summit, and I said one of the great things about it is Harry Dent is a very outspoken guy, no question about it. But when Harry puts on a program, he has people who have a lot of different thoughts about different things in the economy. Some of them may not be on the same parallel with you. And some of them are not going the same direction as you are. And it's great because you have them on the platform so people can hear both sides of it. And I guess, if you will, we could say fair and balanced, because you give them the picture out there and you tell them all the options, and people can make up their own mind. But you pack probably in 3 days more economic things than you would have maybe in 3 years of college.
Yeah. Well, I tell people, I mean, somebody comes to one of our, like you say, a 3-day seminar with us. To me, you're not going to get more information from an MBA in economics at Yale or somewhere. I'm serious. I mean, useful stuff. We show the cycles that count. Like you said, I had a guy from Australia a couple of years ago just because he wrote the best book on real estate cycles I've ever seen. It gets thrown off by things like this central bank manipulation. It gets thrown off by World War I and World War II. But outside of that, incredible cycle. He's more bullish than I am on real estate. But I brought him out because the guy understands cycle, and it literally was the best book I ever read on real estate. So I said, look, our people need to hear this guy.
Yeah, he did an outstanding job, too.
To some degree.
Well, you also had a lady there from the Fed. Here in San Diego, you had somebody from the Fed. I mean, the people who are printing the money.
Well, and we had a lady. This was the fastest talking lady I've ever heard. She was from, she was the chief economist of the U.S. Navy. And man, was she smart. I mean, I tell her, I was clocking her at, you know, 696 words per minute or something, you know. and she knew her stuff. And in this case, she more agreed with us. She was not a proponent of quantitative easing. She thought, you know, that it leads to speculation and stuff and distorts the economy. But again, this was somebody, you know, economist for the Navy, you know. she was very good. That's a, we find somebody like that, we say, look, our people need to hear this.
Oh, yeah, it is outstanding, and I couldn't recommend it enough. Well, listen, Harry, we appreciate you spending part of your Saturday with us, and I look forward to I'll be talking to you before then, but I really look forward to seeing you and Rodney and your whole program in September. I'm excited for it to come.
Okay, great.
Well, listen, thank you very much, Harry. And listen, if you want to get a copy of Harry's book, the Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019, you give us a call, and you give us a call into the station, and you want a free copy, you can pick one up at my office. Just say you listen to this program today, and until they run out, I've got a few books there, and until they run out, you can have a free copy of it if you call in and say you listen to this show. So if you got a question, give us a call. The numbers are out there at 503-417-7626, toll-free 800-990-0075. We're going to take a quick break here, and 0750, that is. And we're going to take a quick break and come right back with Investing Simplified and Carl's comments.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. Now that we've finished up with Harry Dent, it's pretty hard to follow Harry. I can't talk as fast as he can, and I doubt that I'll provide you with as much insight into the world we live in.
You know, Carl, that's got to be one of the fastest 30 minutes in radio.
It does happen quick, and it is kind of a fire hose thing. But I find him fascinating. He's very interesting. And anyway, I'm going to kind of take us back down a little notch, and I just want to start kind of. Sometimes we need to do a little review because not everybody gets to listen every Saturday. And one of the things, you know, when we talk about estate planning, the number one thing most people think about is a will. And so I thought I'd just start with some basic facts about wills. And we haven't talked about that for a while. So, and if this sparks a question for you, please call us at 503-417-7616 or 800-990-0750. That's a hard number to say, isn't it?
Yeah, that is.
990-0750.
Say that real fast.
No. Peter Piper, no. Anyway, so what is a will anyway? A will is a legal expression of a person's wishes as to the disposition of his property or her property after his or her death. In order to be valid in Oregon, a will has three basic requirements, physical requirements, if you will. One is it must be in writing. Number two, it must be signed by the testator. That's the person making the will. Or it may be signed by someone else at the express direction of the testator. In fact, we just did this the other day. We had a fellow who was very ill, and part of his illness prevented him from being able to write. And so we had him tell someone in the room to sign the will, and then there are some little formalities that you go through as far as recognizing that it was signed by somebody else on the will. But anyway, so must be signed by the testator or someone else at the express direction of the testator. It must be signed in the presence of two witnesses who also must sign the will. So those are the three kind of physical elements. Now, it kind of goes without saying, you kind of hear this, that a person of a lot of wills start out with, I, John Jones, being of sound mind. Well, the notion of sound mind really means the legal capacity to sign the will. And I'm not going to get into capacity today, but that's a non-physical element that has to happen. So anytime you talk about what a will has or doesn't have, it has to assume that the person had legal capacity or competence, or as my mother would say, haven't lost your marbles yet, to sign the will. The signature of the testator does not have to be notarized. In fact, generally, it's not. That's an interesting question, but a lot of times it comes up. You would think, well, why not just notarize the will? Well, kind of the witnesses are the persons that sort of notarize it in their sense by witnessing the will. And however, even though the testator doesn't need to have his signature notarized, it's really a good idea or a good practice, and it's not required necessarily, but it's very important to have the witnesses, they sign an attestation, which basically says, I saw him sign the will. He appeared to be of sound mind to me, and so that's basically kind of a little affidavit thing. And those witnesses, their signature must be notarized for that little attestation clause to be valid. Now, the difference there is that the attestation clause with the notary allows the will to be admitted to court for probate without any further evidence. If you don't have that, if you just have the witness's signatures, then you're going to have to either get an affidavit from at least one of those who said, yep, I saw him sign the will, and he said he was, you know, this was his will, and he was of sound mind. Or you have to have somebody dragged into court to testify to that. That's pretty rare that it happens. Usually we can find the witness, but we've done it on a number of occasions. So it's very important that this self-attestation clause is there so that you don't have to go through that. Because who knows, you know, witnesses, you know, go somewhere, die, or, you know, whatever. The other thing is you may not know those witnesses. I know that a lot of times we use my staff folks in the office, and you know, a staff person could go somewhere else, some other law firm. We might not know where they went, and finding that witness might be a problem. So it's a real good idea to get over that hump when you first do the will. The will can do other things, too. It usually nominates a personal representative. Sometimes that's called an executor. Or an executrix if the person happens to be female. And that's the person who gets appointed by the court to administer the estate when the person dies. And they have sort of the legal charge of paying the bills and disposing of the property in accordance with the will's instructions. So there can also be a nomination of a guardian for your minor children. That's very important, especially if you're a single parent and maybe there is no other parent, and one parent has died, and you want to make sure that the kids, your minor children, have the guardian of your choice, not somebody else's. And finally, you can also have a nomination or appointment of a trustee. If your will creates a trust, say for minor children or for a special needs child or for some kind of purpose other than that, so that, in other words, the property that you are giving to this trust or trustee has someone already appointed to carry on and administer that asset or those monies until after you die. So that's another thing that happens in there. Wills are revocable by their nature. They're the testator, so long as they're competent and alive and all, they can be amended. However, after they die, that's it. You know, because a will only really comes into effect until the person dies. After the will, the will cannot be revoked and cannot be amended. And even if it's wrong, I mean, even if it's incorrectly done, the lawyer made a mistake or something, it's not fixable. And that can happen sometimes. So you want to read those wills pretty carefully as to make sure they're doing what you want them to do. Finally, it's a common misconception that if I have a will, I don't have to go through probate. Generally, not true. If you own property in your own name, the likelihood is you're going to have to go through probate, or you're not going to. Your heirs are going to go through probate, and that's the court proceeding that ultimately distributes the property using your personal representative, you know, named in your will. And there are some exceptions, and that is where you have property that's jointly held or with right of survivorship, insurance policies, joint bank accounts, various kinds of financial accounts that have transfer on death or pay on death designations. Those things pass by operation of law and do not go through probate. The important thing there is to remember that the will has no effect on those particular assets. So that means that when you do a will and you do your estate planning, you want to make sure that if you have pay on death designations or beneficiary designation type property, and you have other kind of property that will go through the will, that those two things work together to make sure that those properties go in the way that you want them to go. So those are some of the thoughts I have on basics of wills. If you have any other questions, I'd really welcome your call. We're at 503-417-7616 and 800-990-0750.
You know, Carl, is very interesting because I, we hear all kinds of different things, and I had a person contact me this week and said they were concerned about their estate planning, and they had heard something on the radio on another show that if they had over a $50,000 estate, that they need to set up a trust and do some estate planning, and I said, well, you know, really, at $50,000, you're probably okay. Do you have a will, and do you have things set up? And she didn't, of course, which I referred her to you to set up a will. But I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. I think people hear things, and sometimes you may hear something that you think. But I always tell people, look, and one of the things we constantly say on this show, everybody's situation is different. You need to pick up the phone, call a professional, call an attorney, and call Carl, or call somebody if you're thinking about a will or you're thinking about estate planning. Talk to somebody about your specific situation. We're going to give you some general ideas, but ours is certainly not a planning. This is not a planning show where you can plan your estate or you can plan your investment portfolio. We just give you some simple ideas, but you need to follow up and do your own planning with a professional.
You know, that's really true. And I get a lot of questions. I get like a voicemail that says, how much is a simple will? Well, that's a question that's almost impossible to answer because a lot of times people don't know what they mean by a simple will. And I begin to talk with them, and their situation is such that it's significantly more complex. There are some people who have really what we just have a real simple will, and then I'll tell them that. But it's very difficult. You know, it's not like I have a price list that says this is what a simple will costs. Because if I did that, I'd probably be out of business because it's just not that easy. Most lawyers, I think, are. I don't know for sure, but I like to be really upfront with the fees that I charge. And usually the way that I do it is I have to find out what's going on. I have to find out what it is we're going to do before I can tell you how much I think it's going to cost. And unfortunately, people kind of want to know that in advance. And please be patient with us because honestly, unless we know something about your estate, something about what you want done with it, and those kinds of things, it's very, very difficult for a lawyer to tell you how much the whole process might take. And we don't want to, you know, mislead you in some fashion.
Well, you know, Carl, that's so true in your industry and mine as well, because people will say to us, well, what are your fees? And it depends on the managed portfolio you go into and the type of investment you go into. But here's what I would say from a standpoint of working with your attorney, working with your financial planner, or working with your CPA. It's not so much the amount that you pay, and that certainly is a consideration. However, it's the results that you get out of what you're paying for. And it's just like, you know, I tell people, look, if I had a heart attack today and I went into my doctor and he said, you got to have heart surgery. The first question I'm not going to ask is how much is the heart surgeon? I'm going to ask how dang good are they? Is it the best heart surgeon in the country? I want him. I don't care the cost because it's your life. Same thing with your estate plan or your investing or your taxes. You want the best you can get. It's not always the cheapest. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to Investing Simplified. Sorry we had a snafu on the air, but hopefully you'll let us know. And please don't hesitate to email me, Chuck at pfgwm.com. Thank you very much.
Price Financial Group Wealth Financial Group Wealth Management.